Welcome to the Real Python Podcast. This is episode 282. How do you create automated tests to check your code for degraded performance as data sizes increase? What are the new features for Pandas 3.0? Christopher Trudeau is back on the show this week, bringing another batch of PyCoders Weekly articles and projects. Christopher digs into an article about building tests to make sure your software is fast, or at least doesn't get slower as it scales. The piece focuses on big O scaling and its implications for algorithms. We discuss another piece that covers the top features for Pandas 3.0. The article showcases the new dedicated string dtype, a cleaner way to perform column-based operations, and a more predictable default copying behavior with copy on write. We also share several other articles and projects from the Python community, including a collection of recent releases and PEPs, a profiler for targeting individual functions, a quiz to test your Django knowledge, when to use each of the 8 versions of UUID, the hard-to-swallow truths about being a software engineer, an offline reverse geocoding library, and a library for auto-generating CLIs from any Python object. And just a note, if you've been thinking about leveling up your Python skills, our live cohort courses start February 2nd, and we're down to the last few seats. We've got 2 options: Python for beginners, if you're still building your foundation, and intermediate deep dive, if you're ready to master decorators, generators, and the patterns senior developers use. Both are 8 weeks of live instruction with small groups and real accountability. And if it's not the right fit, there's a full refund guarantee. Head to realpython.com/live to grab one of the remaining seats. If you support web apps in production, you don't need junk logs. You need intelligent logging with real-time error alerts, automatic deduping, and actionable context. Honeybadger filters out the noise and transforms your Python logs into context-rich issues so you can find and fix errors before your users notice. Sign up for your free developer account at honeybadger.io. That's honeybadger.io. All right, let's get started. The Real Python Podcast is a weekly conversation about using Python in the real world. My name is Christopher Bailey, your host. Each week, we feature interviews with experts in the community and discussions about the topics, articles, and courses found at realpython.com. After the podcast, join us and learn real-world Python skills with a community of experts at realpython.com. Hey, Chris, welcome back.
Hi there.
All right, so we have our usual lineup. Got some releases, some PEPs in the news section here. Got a couple articles. In fact, one of mine is a release. So, and then a little bit of a discussion along with some projects this week. You ready to dig in?
Yeah, let's go for it.
All right, let's start with the news.
Yeah, let's start with the news. Some release stuff to begin with. Python 3.15 Alpha 4 came out, and then following on its heels rather quickly was Alpha 5 due to a mistake in the build process. And, you know, just for giggles, Alpha 6 is just around the corner, so things keep chucking along. The folks at Django seem to want to compete with the PSF, and they also have pushed something out. There was a bug fix release for 5.2.10 and 6.0.1. The first was just a couple small fixes, while the second, the 6.0.1, had a whole bunch of things, including some regressions, which, you know, the typical stuff that happens after you do a .0 release. And then there was a big one. Pandas 3.0 has been announced. I don't want to take the wind out of Mr. Bailey's sails, so I'll shut up right there. moving on from releases to proposals. PEP 819 is titled JSON Package Metadata. A Python package can already contain metadata information inside of it. This proposal outlines a way of storing that data as JSON, making it easier for automation tools to consume the information. Next is PEP 820, which is titled PySlot, Unified Slot System for the C API. This one gets down in the weeds. It has to do with how Python objects are created under the covers. There was some work done in these structures in 3.14, and this PEP cleans some of that up and solidifies some more of it. And then the last PEP is one that I kind of like and hope gets there, is 822 is dedented multi-line strings. You know how if you have a multi-line string, you are faced with either the choice of adding indents so the code looks good, but that means having extra work on the string, or not having the indents so the string looks good, but the code's a mess? Well, this PEP outlines an idea called a D-string. Like with other suffixes, FRT, this would define special behavior. Huh. In this case, automatically removing indentation. They're doing something kind of clever here, which is using the indentation of the closing quote as the indicator as to how much indentation to remove. So this feels kind of clean to me, and it's always been something that kind of annoyed me. I don't know, it's just my OCD. But I hope this makes this into 315. I think it'll be kind of neat. And then remember, boys and girls, no GNUs is good GNUs with Gary GNU. Yeah, I expect like two people to get that, but it makes me laugh. So what a GNU got?
As was lightly hinted there, there is a new version of Pandas, Pandas 3.0. Our friend over at CodeCut, Quinn Tran, did an article about it, and it's literally called What's New in Pandas 3.0. And what's funny about it is it was released slightly earlier than the release. The release was on the 21st, so a week ago Thursday, as far as when this comes out. I guess the one thing you can skip in the article is installing from the release candidate. You can just install Pandas 3.0 at this point. It digs into three major features. Past the colon of what's new in Pandas is expressions, copy on write, and faster strings. The article digs into each one and actually features a Jupyter notebook that you can follow along with. So continuing that theme of data science-y kind of stuff, of letting you play with it a little bit here with data frames. The first one is something that Chris and I, who are fans of Polars, have liked a lot and has been sort of influenced by that inside of Pandas here. Cleaner column operations with a thing called pd.col or pd call column. If you want to modify an existing column or create a new one, typical approach would be to use square bracket type notation with the name of the column in the brackets. You use that same style notation for the new column you're adding. So like an example would be maybe you got a temperature column and you're trying to work between Canada and the US here and figure out your temperatures. And so that's the example they're using. The data frame DF, square brackets, temperature F, this is the new column you're creating, equals DF, square brackets, temperature C, so in Celsius, and then that's multiplied by 9/5 plus 32. You then would see that that has added this new column. One thing that you may not realize is that this now has overwritten the original data frame. So if you want to compare your original data frame with something new, then you really want to make a copy first. Another issue with the old style is if you want to do method chaining, you chain a few things together and then you want to see the result in the data frame, it will return a new data frame instead of modifying what's there in place. Along with that, to make that work, you typically use a lambda function. And I really like the narrative that Quinn set up here in the sort of explanation of this big pitfall that you're going to fall into. Lambda functions capture variables by reference and not by value, which can cause bugs. And so she sets this one up. Lambdas really don't save the values. They save variable names. So in her example, the multiple lambdas being used within a loop to address multiple columns. She's kind of addressing three different columns with this loop. All point to the same variable. The final value is what actually gets used in the loop. In the end, it's like it was going from like 10 to 20 to 30. In this case, it just ended up providing them all with the value of 30. It's kind of a weird hiccup that maybe people didn't know would happen to them by using a lambda this way. The next code snippet she has uses the temperature conversion and the new column, the pd.col feature, which also supports method chaining. And unlike a lambda, it doesn't work by reference, so it avoids the whole last bug. So she shows a few other kind of nice examples of making that work and it being a lot more straightforward as far as like what's happening instead of this sort of like having to use the square brackets to reference things and getting kind of unusual results. She shows like filtering with expressions and then combining multiple columns together. One note is that COL doesn't work well with the group by operations at this time. So maybe that's something that will happen in future versions. So some aggregation things of using group by will not work at the moment. The next one is something that I think most people who've worked with pandas have seen. You've probably gotten the dreaded setting with copy warning. My favorite reaction to this was one of the workplaces I was in, and I was new to pandas, and I was doing some stuff with taking someone else's work, checking it over, and I kept seeing this warning screaming at me in the code when I would run it. The person said to me, well, it's fine. Don't worry about it. It's just a warning. And I was like, okay, but I don't think this is a proper way of doing this. There's got to be some way to, around this. So anyway, I had done a bunch of research. We have actually a really good article about it on Real Python. But so when pandas shares memory, when reading data, like filtering, what pandas is telling you with that is that it can't tell if you're modifying a view or a copy of your data. So is it modifying something and kind of just displaying it to you, or is it actually making a true copy of what's happening in the data? Pandas 3 makes the answer now simple. Filtering always returns a copy. Copy on write, or COW, is how it's being expressed in their documentation. Pandas shares memory when reading data, like filtering. And only when you change to like a new data frame does pandas actually create a separate copy. I like this feature. I think it's going to help a lot. The last one, which I think is kind of one of the more interesting ones, is a problem that's been with pandas for a long time, which is how does it handle strings? And now there's a dedicated string D type or data type. Pandas 2 stored strings as an object, which is very slow and not very clarifying as to what the data actually is there. And so the idea behind object would be that it could be anything. It could be a string, a list, dictionary, a floats, or it could be just purely strings. So in this case, you get a lot more performance by having an actual true string data type. And it's backed by PyArrow. So you need PyArrow installed in your Pandas 3.0. So I'll include the documentation that's actually from Pandas there that talks a little bit about that. String operations will run 5 to 10 times faster because PyArrow processes data in contiguous memory blocks instead of individual Python objects. And memory usage is reduced by up to 50% since strings are stored in a compact binary format rather than as Python objects with overhead. The last note in the article, which is that the Arrow ecosystem interoperability. One thing that I talked a lot to, Marco Gorelli, a few different people from Polars and people from the Pandas teams about this idea of Arrow being able to operate inside of RAM so that when you have a data frame, if it's using Arrow inside of Pandas, it can be passed to another Arrow-based tool. So you, instead of having to do a conversion and say, oh, I need to push this into Polars, or I need to convert this into DuckDB, without copying or converting it, it can actually just work inside those libraries, which is really cool. Something that you should check out. So this Arrow ecosystem has helped this interoperability of being able to keep things right there in memory and not have to do another copy or conversion in order for it to work. The Pandas team also released in their documentation, again, it came out on the 21st, they're what's new on 3.0. I'll include a link. The list of the enhancements are actually in the reverse order from what she had mentioned. They use the dedicated string type being the first thing, a consistent copy slash view behavior with copy on write, and then the initial support for their pd.col function there, that syntax to create expressions along with a few others. So thanks again, Quinn. Always good stuff coming from CodeCut. If you support web apps in production, you don't need junk logs. You need intelligent logging that helps you find and fix errors before your users notice them. Honeybadger filters out the noise and transforms your Python logs into context-rich issues so you can put out fires faster. Real-time error alerts accelerate your reaction times. Automatic deduping boosts signal-to-noise ratio, and advanced search and query tools help you dig deep into issues. Find and fix errors faster for free. Visit honeybadger.io to sign up for your free developer account. That's honeybadger.io. All right, so what do you got next?
My first article this week is by Itamar Turner Trowing, who we've covered articles from 9 times before. So this is lucky number 10.
Oh, wow.
Itamar's blog is pythonspeed.com, and as you might guess from the name, it's typically about performance. One of his more recent articles is titled Unit Testing Your Code's Performance, and subtitled Big O Scaling. In case you're unfamiliar, Big O notation is a mathematical upper bound on an algorithm's performance. It's expressed with a capital O, parameterized by the number of items being fed into the algorithm. So O-N, often pronounced order N, means the algorithm scales linearly, meaning if I add one extra item for processing, I'm going to get a proportionate amount of extra time to process. Order n squared means the processing time is proportionate to the square of the number of items being acted upon. So, for example, nested loops are often n squared since the inner loop runs fully for each item in the outer loop. That's the general idea. The thesis of Itamar's article is that if you're trying to keep an eye on the performance of your code, you can write unit tests that are interested in the scalability of the code. So instead of just checking how fast it takes to process, say, 10 items, you check whether you've broken the Big O bounding on your algorithm. For common algorithms, the bounds are fairly well known. For your own code, you might just sit down and go through it and work it out. Or if all that sounds like too much effort, there's a Python library that determines this empirically. The library is called Big O, naturally enough, and it works kind of like a profiler. It comes with a decorator, which you wrap the function you're interested in. Then you run your code or test that runs your code, and you get a JSON data file. The library comes with a command that ingests this data and outputs PDF files, so you get a nice little graph showing you the results with an inferred performance bound. The library also comes with a method called assert bounds, which you can use in your tests. And this is what the article suggests. You determine your current bound that hopefully you're happy with, and then write a test that tests your code and asserts against that bound. Then, if you muck with your code in such a way that the performance boundary changes, the test will fail. The advantage of this approach is it catches the kinds of errors that can be really problematic at scale, without being finicky about the variability of performance test data that can change locally because of your cache or other things running on your machine or the phase of the moon or whatever else causes that kind of stuff. So it's a pretty solid idea. And of course, you could write these kinds of tests on the core parts of your algorithm where performance is important rather than having to do it on the whole project. So there's good advice here. Itamar is promising a follow-up article on more performance testing, so I suspect we might be covering number 11 when it arrives.
I saw that GitHub link that you shared with the Big O project, and it said plasma.umass, and I was like, I know that. So a guest I had in episode 172, Emery Berger, came on the show to talk about one of his performance profiling tools called Scalene. And so this is a yet another tool by that lab. They're very focused on performance. So it's good to see you still working on some stuff.
Yeah, Itamar mentions that library in the article as well.
It's a neat library. Gosh, we're kind of profiling and performance focused here for a little bit. My next piece digs into that a bit. It's from Adam Johnson, who we've had on the show a few times, and we also feature fairly often. And in fact, he's going to be my guest next week, coming on to talk about improving your GitHub developer experience. He did a book that we featured called Improving Your Git DX. This one is the GitHub version. So we dig into that quite a bit. This particular piece on his blog is about a new tool that he developed, actually working on something inside of Django's system checks framework. And so he was inspired to build this. So there's also another article that's like the one just before this, where he's talking about working on that and him thinking about, oh, maybe there's a way to do this. So this one is called Introducing TPROF, T-P-R-O-F, a targeting profiler. Again, diving deeper into this idea. Profilers usually measure the performance of a whole program and to identify where time is being spent. It will, you know, depending on the profiler, show details of where it did spend the time in those things, but usually, again, it runs across the whole thing. It can be a little problematic if there's a particular function you want within those results, and you want to say, okay, well, I want to isolate this function and see what its performance is. You end up running the whole thing again, which takes more time, can also add to the performance of it and can cause a little bit of troubleshooting issues. So I want to just focus on one function that I'm going to try to improve or work on it. And so he details a little bit about how he did this. It does require Python 3.12 or higher. It measures the time spent inside that particular function you target, and you can use it on the command line to generate this really concise report with columns in it. He gives an example about creating paths using pathlib. He doesn't provide the code of the example program, but he shows how it's running. So it'd be on the command line tprof-t pathlib colon path, and then in this case, dunder new, because that's when it's creating these new paths, and then the name of the program. So the results will then show in a little table of columns inside your terminal, function name, the amount of calls that were done on that particular function, and then the total time it took for those, sort of a mean inside there, and then a min and max, giving you these basic stats. He does a benchmarking thing where he's like, okay, well, what if you want to compare between one function and another, or maybe an old version of the function and a new version of the function? So he names these two in his example before and after going through a loop to create a sum of 100,000 numbers using range. And then the next one, the versus being using the built-in sum function. And in that one, when it runs, you say tprof-x, again, doing a comparison, and then the before, and then the after, and then the name of the program. It does all the columns I described just a moment ago, but there's now a new column, which then calculates the delta. In his particular example, it's like a minus 62% difference. So sum being built in is a lot faster than just you doing it inside of a for loop and adding it together. Tprof also provides a Python API via a context manager or decorator. And you can use it then to profile functions within certain blocks of code. He wraps up a short section about how it works and how the introduction of this new API, sys.monitoring in Python 3.12, which was designed for triggering events when functions or lines of code are executed, helped him with that. He throws a thank you out to Mark Shannon for contributing to sys.monitoring. The tool is ready to go. You can play with it and install it from PyPI. So thanks, Adam.
Doesn't surprise me that this comes out of a Django guy, because anytime you're dealing with a framework, you're not calling the code yourself. Something else is calling your code, right? Like you, in the case of Django, you're hitting the web page and then a bunch of magic happens and then your view gets called. So if you're trying to optimize the view inside of a profiler, you've got all that stuff that's sitting on top of it. So I can see this being really, really helpful for anything with a framework, because then you can zone in on the thing that you actually want to optimize. And in fact, in that case, the thing you actually have control over, because if the framework's the reason it's slow, then you can't do anything about it. So yeah, this kind of makes sense to me.
Yeah. This is going to be the year of profiling. Yes. I think we already said this once.
I think there's going to be a real focus on it. Yeah.
Yeah. The one that's coming in the new version of Python is going to be very interesting. But yeah, there's a lot of focus on measuring these performance gains that have been coming in.
Well, and there have been changes in CPython recently that yes. allow you to do things that you wouldn't have been able to do before as well. So I think there's going to be a lot of code taking advantage of some of the changes in 3.14.
Yeah. And then hooks being put in, obviously, that allow you to see what's happening, monitor what's happening, which is good. It's time to shine a spotlight on another Real Python video course. Object-Oriented Programming, or OOP, is one of the most significant and essential topics in programming. And this course is designed to provide you with a solid foundation of the concepts of object-oriented programming. The course is titled Intro to Object-Oriented Programming in Python, and it's based on a Real Python tutorial by David Amos. The video course is presented by Joseph Pert, and in it, you'll learn how to define custom types using classes and how to instantiate those classes into Python objects that can be used throughout your programs. You'll learn how to work with attributes and how to provide your classes with behavior using methods. You also discover how classes can inherit from one another, which enables you to write maintainable and less redundant Python code. Getting a solid foundation to object-oriented programming in Python is a worthy investment of your time. And like most of the video courses on Real Python, the course is broken into easily consumable sections. Each lesson includes a transcript, including closed captions, and you'll have access to code samples for the techniques shown. You could find a link in this episode's show notes, or you can find it using the search tool on realpython.com. Adam also does an annual Django quiz. So I have a link to his Django quiz 2025. He does this quiz as part of a Django London meetup group. So it's an annual tradition at that meetup, and now you can take it yourself, or you can just skip to the answers, but maybe challenge yourself if you're interested in honing your Django skills there. So what's your next one here?
Next, I've got something by Nicole Tietz-Sokoskaya, and it's titled 8 Versions of UUID and When to Use Them. UUID is short for Universally Unique Identifier, and it's a number or string, more accurately, of text that guarantees that it is unique across usage. This unique spans everything, not just a single program. So for example, if you and I both have a database that contains these kinds of IDs, and then we merged our databases, we shouldn't get a conflict. Microsoft tends to call this same concept a GUID, or Global Unique Identifier, in case you've come across that term as well. There is a standard for generating these kinds of IDs, and there are different types you can use, 8 of them, as you might have guessed from the title. Most of them combine different things to achieve this uniqueness, and some of them are only probabilistically unique. So UUID version 1 combines a timestamp, a monotonic counter, and a MAC address. So the timestamp uses 100 nanosecond intervals, which used to be really fast, and now that's a lot of processing time, which is why there is also a counter. So in case your computer is generating multiple UIDs within a 100 nanosecond time slice, you'll get a different value each time. A MAC address is a unique identifier that's on your network card, so by combining these things, you get something that in theory is unique across the universe. Granted, MAC addresses can be faked, but, you know, nothing is perfect. Some of the 8 versions of UUID were created to solve different kinds of problems, and some of them are meant to replace other versions. I'm not going to go over all 8. I'll just cover 2 of the ones that Nicole recommends in the article. Version 4 is a good default choice if you just need a random value. It's 128 bits, so collision is unlikely. One advantage of this one is that it can be generated very quickly. The downside of it is probabilistic. It's really just a random number, so in theory, you can get repetition here. An improvement on version 4 is version 7. It combines a timestamp and a random value. Again, this one's only probabilistic, but it definitely really reduces the likelihood of a collision. The timestamp is the prefix part of the value, meaning that this UUID is actually sortable, which makes it a good choice for values in your database. Nicole's article isn't Python specific, so if you're looking at using UUIDs, you should check out the UUID module in the standard library. It contains mechanisms for managing and generating the values, including functions called UUID1 through UUID8, which generate the different kinds of identifiers. So, interesting little bit here. This is one of those concepts that you come across every once in a while and you're like, what? Well, how am I supposed to? Which is, why should I? And so it's nice to have a little bit of advice on which of these you should choose.
What's been your experience?
I think it's 7 I use most of the time. One of the challenges with UUIDs is they are, so that the length is standardized and they take up a lot of space.
Yeah.
I can count on one hand the number of times I truly needed one that had to be unique across multiple processes and across multiple systems. Most of the time, you just need something that's unique locally to your own thing. And then a timestamp and a little bit of a random number gives you something smaller. Or, of course, if you've got a database, you just use an incrementing counter.
Yeah.
So Microsoft in particular seemed to be very obsessive about these for a while. They were attaching GUIDs everywhere. So if you're doing a lot of Windows programming, you may bump into them. But yeah, it's another tool in the tool chest.
Yeah. I mean, I was doing increments for a lot of the projects, and then there's been only a handful of projects where, okay, this makes more sense. And the timestamp definitely, like, to me, adds that, like, okay, well, yeah, if I want to sort this,
yeah,
or, you know, want to get some other information out of it, it kind of makes more sense.
It starts to become more important with distributed computing.
Yes.
Because if my processor is generating something and your processor is generating something, and then eventually we're merging the data, you got to make sure that you're not bumping into each other.
Right. And that makes sure your timestamp works too then.
Yes.
All right. So we have a bit of a discussion. It's a piece by Mensur Durakovic. The title of it is 10 Hard to Swallow Truths They Won't Tell You About Software Engineering Jobs.
So the premise in the article really boils down to the fact that often what you learn in school isn't everything you might need in a job. So let me just summarize Mensur's 10 points before we dig in. Point number one is college will not prepare you for the jobs. Right out of the bat, we're right there. He uses the analogy that school prepares you for a coding job like learning to swim without touching water readies you to hit the pool. And your first day at work is often kind of like being thrown in the deep end.
Yeah.
Point number two is you will rarely get greenfield projects. Most professional coding involves existing code. Point number three, nobody gives an F*** about your clean code. I'll let you fill in the blanks yourself there. Code is a tool for companies to get profit. Point number four, you will sometimes work with incompetent people. Point number five, I'm surprised you didn't giggle there. Point number five,
I was going to wait till they're together.
Get used to being in meetings for hours.
With incompetent people.
Yes, that's true. Point number six, they will ask you for estimates a lot. Point number seven, bugs will be your arch enemy for life. I have no idea what he's talking about. Point number eight, uncertainty will be your toxic friend. This one kind of ties back to the estimation piece, but that uncertainty is also connected to unknowns about libraries, moving to new projects, moving to a new company, teaching tech itself changing, and you know, there's uncertainty everywhere. Point number nine, it will be almost impossible for you to disconnect from your job. And point number 10, you will profit more from good soft skills than from good technical skills. So, as long as we don't discuss the incompetent person and drop names, we'll probably be okay. But what did you want to dig into here?
Actually, I want to start with number nine just briefly because I think that is a skill, a life skill. And it could be any job that you have. And you need to figure it out.
You're talking about number 10.
No, I mean number 9, the ability to disconnect from your job.
Sorry.
And I don't find that as concerning personally, but I think maybe for a younger person getting into it, that this might be a trap that you might fall into. And again, a lot of these are like that, I guess.
I think number 9 is a little, some of these are a little personality based and yes, some of them aren't. And although I will admit that I think the kinds of things that make people good programmers often are the kinds of things that makes it difficult for people to disconnect from the job, right? Like,
yeah.
If you're going to look for commas for hours to fix your code, as it's kind of an obsessive compulsive sort of industry, right? So it's not surprising that people sometimes have a hard time dropping it.
Yeah. The other one I want to touch on, number one is the most straightforward one. Like, yeah, college will not prepare you for the job. He focuses on the idea that there are a lot of issues with education generally. The information they're sending out into the world is often very stale, and they aren't necessarily preparing you for real world sort of situations. And I think that just totally depends on, you know, where you're getting your instruction from. That could be true of a boot camp too, you know. And I think the rest of it where, like, yeah, your day to day and potentially problems you're going to have aren't necessarily going to be with the code. So
I know when I was in school, a lot of the time, the coding courses we were taking were not using languages that were used in the field very often. And anytime anybody complained about it, the standard answer from the prof, and at the time I rolled my eyes, but I think there's some truth to it, was this isn't a skill training school. This is a place where you're learning how to learn.
Right.
And whether you're using the latest and greatest or not, the concept of references and values and pointers, we're going to use a language so you can see those things, and whether or not you'll be using that tomorrow in your co-op or whatever, you know, that wasn't the point behind it. I do, like I said, I think I kind of rolled my eyes at it at the time,
right?
But I do kind of understand it, right? Like your school is partially about learning to learn, right?
Right. I think that is probably one of the biggest things that is my problem with the use of LLMs inside of college right now, is, are you learning how to learn?
Yeah.
Are you learning how to struggle?
Yeah.
And I had some conversations over the last year about a lot of this. And yeah, it's shifting landscape and so forth, and it depends on the student and so forth. But I agree, you know, that's the ultimate outcome, hopefully, from your college experience, is that you continue to want to learn. And that's a personality trait also.
Yeah. Well, like I can tell, like university for me was a real slap in the face, right? Like I did not have to work very hard before that.
Okay.
And so like when I got to university, all of a sudden I had to, not only did I have to learn the stuff they were making me learn, but now I had to develop things like study habits and stuff like that, right?
Oh, yeah.
My sister was trying to get into a program that there were very, very few spots for. So although she's a smart lady, she knew she was going to have to work her butt off to get in there. And by the time she got in, her study skills were way better than mine because she had to do that and she knew she had to do that, right? So, and I think kind of part of the point in the article is you are going to hit this eventually. And it's probably better that you hit this in school than you hit it at work.
Yeah, yeah.
To your point, if you're LLMing to get your A+, that ain't going to get you where you need to be.
Yeah. I mean, that's a new set of skills that are very different, but I think the motivation behind it is going to be really interesting to see kind of what happens with it. And it kind of relates to the second one, you know, because I've had this conversation too, like, how do those tools that you're learning how to use behave with greenfield projects versus legacy projects? And then there is one really nice comment at the bottom of the piece that somebody said, hey, should you get the opportunity to work on a greenfield project, someday it shall be someone's legacy project.
Yes.
So
this is also one that varies from job to job, right? So, right. Data science,
right,
a lot more greenfield.
Yeah,
app development maybe a little more if you're at a bank.
Yeah, that's the thing.
The closest to green you're gonna get is an off brown, right?
Like, yeah, I mean, you know, often it may be green as a shade of like I'm moving all of our stuff to this new platform.
Yes.
Yeah, making our code work on that or what have you there. But yeah, that is one big difference with data science, or a lot of people that join this language and learn how to use it, they're using it as a way to build on top of skills that they already have inside of an office or inside of a data science team or what have you. And so their projects are not these massive multi-connected types of things. They can be, but often they're, you know, smaller types of things. And so that's one difference depending on, you know, when you talk about a software engineering job versus like using Python as code.
Yeah. Yeah. Point number three, which is nobody cares about your clean code. This is the one I'm not 100% I fully agree on. What he's trying to get at here is the company
doesn't care
because ultimately what you're trying to do is solve a problem, which is so that you can sell something. That being said, I think there's a balancing act here. And that balancing act is maintainability.
Right.
So if your code isn't clean enough, yes, this might get you there, but dirty code results in technical debt. Too much technical debt means you're not going to be able to change over time. The challenge I find with as a software engineer is if you've got to balance this, because every day someone's going, I just need this tomorrow. Don't worry about it. Just give it to me tomorrow.
Right.
Well, eventually someone's also got to maintain it, right? So there's this knack to trying to figure out how do I make sure that the business isn't shooting themselves in the foot because we're going to have to maintain this code versus am I trying to be a purist about it? And I think that takes a lot of practice to learn, and I suspect I still suck at it, right? Like this is one of those things sometimes you get on your high horse and you're like, well, but this is the right way to do it. And I'm like, why is it taking me 3 days when it should be an hour? Well, it's because I'm being a purist. And I think I might reuse this eventually, except I won't, right? So that I think that's kind of what he's trying to get at, but it is definitely a balancing act.
Yeah. I mean, I've had these conversations about becoming a professional.
Yeah.
And that idea of thinking about the maintainability, the, you know, ability to expand your code and all those kinds of things are new conversations for a lot of people when they join an organization that they're not used to. And clean is an interesting term, you know, I think also there.
Yes.
I can agree with like, you know, being fastidious about it versus like, you know, making it so that it's extensible and usable and, you know, and understandable. That's a whole other thing.
And you know, as a callback to our fast versus slow conversation, clean is also
a
subjective thing, right? So
yeah.
There's three points here that I think actually kind of tie together.
Six, seven, eight?
Well, get used to being in meetings. They're going to ask you for a lot of estimates, and good soft skills will see you out through good technical skills. One of the dangers, you know, if coding's your hobby and you do this on your own, you may really hate your job because it's almost impossible to do that as a coding professional. Because as a coding professional, you're building something for somebody else. And as a result of building something for somebody else, you are going to have to interact with somebody that could be a proxy to that person who's getting the software, some sort of analyst.
Right.
But you're going to have to interact with them to understand what the requirements are. As soon as money is involved, someone wants to know when it's done, which means they want to have estimates to go along with it. And of course, all of this stuff requires meetings. So you can have deep conversations about how can you minimize this so that you can be more productive. And some organizations are better at that than others. But there's a reality here. And it's something I find professional coders complain about a lot. Like I often get into those, well, there's too many meetings here. I'm like, okay, well, how are you going to know what to build tomorrow if we don't have a conversation about this, right?
Right.
And I understand the desire to stick your head down and code, but if you're not building what actually solves the client's problem, then that's a problem in itself. And so there's a aspect to this, which really comes down to you're going to have to deal with people. You're going to have to figure out what requirements are to varying degrees. And that means things like meetings and estimates. And so there's value in learning how to be a little better at that. It doesn't have to be your favorite thing.
Right.
Nobody goes into the industry because, hey, I want to spend all my time in meetings. Then you'd be in management.
Yeah.
But, you know, there are good ways and bad ways of doing this, and you're not going to be successful without some aspect of it.
I wonder about, like, these sort of skill building, you know, sort of ongoing education things that people have, like if communication is just too wide of a thing to throw in there. But, like, I feel like that's a huge part of it, just like, you know, people talking past each other and stuff like that.
There are... One of the companies that I work with, we have a series of like training courses that focuses on this kind of stuff. And a lot of it really is like the hints, right? Like how to know, you know, how to catch yourself. Wait a second, I'm not actually listening. Okay. You know, how to figure that out for yourself so that you can, you know, get a little better at that. When somebody is, they're angry at you or angry at the fact that the deadline's been missed, like techniques you can use to try to address that and try to get to the heart of the matter. So there are things out there that if this is a skill you want to build that can help. My usual advice to people who are new to it is find somebody at your organization who's good at it and get them to give you feedback and try to mirror what they're doing, because that's what it is. It takes practice, right? So courses can help, but practice makes a big difference.
Yeah. I've harped on this before on the show, but you know, I worked for a long time at a school that was preparing students to work in the music industry, which is pretty varied. You know, it could be working on, you know, the big albums and things like that, but you could be working in live sound, you could be working in a church, you could be working in a venue, you could be working video games or, you know, somewhere on movie and TV and so forth. There's a lot of uses for sound podcasts. Anyway, in the end, you're going to be working with people. So being able to work with people and understanding that your future in that career is also about getting people to speak well of you. And you're not going to get a lot of referrals if you are a difficult person to work with. And that's hard, you know, for a lot of people to think about. And it's true of, you know, working inside of an organization. And so I agree with it. It's just something that's kind of this universal truth that's across the board. I don't know, unless you're starting your own company, but even then, who's going to want to work with you? It's always kind of baffling.
You got to convince a bank to give you money.
Yeah, that too, always, also. Yeah. Yeah. All right. You ready to get into projects?
Yeah, let's go.
Okay. So I have a kind of a smaller project. It's called Gazetteer, and it's an offline reverse geocoding library. So in this particular case, you're sort of starting with your latitude and longitude and then trying to find out where this location is. As they describe it, a simple, fully offline, accurate, boundary-based reverse geocoding library in Python. It's by user Sora, SOORAJTS 2001. So that's as much as I got. They seem to be from India and have somebody else who's working on the project with them. And reverse geocoding is this process of finding valid address out of coordinates that include county, state, country, etc. Why use a library like this? It provides more accurate results than point-based computing counterparts. It provides up to 3 administrative divisions. Again, the county, the state, town, cities, regions, and boundaries inside there. Boundary validation is computed on the fly, which makes it extremely fast and efficient. And then there's, I think the main reason behind this library is there's no max usage or rate limits since everything is running on your device fully offline. The boundary ambiguity of invalid address near border regions, since it's validating the boundary itself. The tool that they're using is called Geo Boundaries, the library they're using, again, sort of this offline thing. The conventional way of doing this was using commercial APIs like Google Maps or Mapbox. They are a lot more accurate, but they are costly in nature and they come with rate limits. If you're doing large data intensive applications, this can incur these sort of limitations. I think it's an interesting project because we've discussed geocoding often. You know, we can talk about mapping and things like that. I think if you're interested in this topic, it's a nice way to kind of see how this project's put together. It's one of these things where it actually goes through and finds the 3 nearest neighbors. And so I think it's an interesting coding problem that they're trying to solve through this project. So again, if you're interested in geolocation, I think it's a cool Python project to check out. What's your one?
I've got something called Python Fire, and it's from a small organization you may have heard about. I think it's pronounced Google. There we go. Python Fire is for generating command line interfaces from Python objects. And since everything in Python is an object...
Ooh.
Did you miss it?
The return.
That, of course, includes functions as well. So the first example in the docs is a simple hello world function that has a name argument. And at the bottom of this file, you put your usual script under main kind of section, and then you instantiate a fire object and pass in the function as a reference. The result then is that the script automatically supports dash dash name for the argument to the hello function, as well as dash dash help, you know, your typical things that you might create with argparse or another equivalent library. If instead of a function you declare a class, then the command line uses a sub-argument structure where each method in the class is a command for your script, and then the arguments for the methods become dash dash args. So there's loads of different libraries out there for doing interesting command line stuff, but if you need something quick, this is probably one of the simplest that I've seen out there. So if you're trying to get there quickly, it might be worth checking out.
Cool. Command line interfaces are always a great way to start to show off your work and share it with others. All right. Well, thanks again for bringing all these projects and articles and news this week again, Chris.
Happy to be here.
All right. Talk to you soon. And don't forget, if you support web apps and production, you don't need junk logs. You need intelligent logging with real-time error alerts, automatic deduping, and actionable context. Honey Badger filters out the noise and transforms your Python logs into context-rich issues so you can find and fix errors before your users notice. Sign up for your free developer account at honeybadger.io. That's honeybadger.io. I want to say thanks to Christopher Trudeau for coming on the show again this week. And I want to thank you for listening. If you like the episode, a great way to help us grow our audience is to share it with other Python users who you think might enjoy it. You can also leave a rating or a review on your podcast platform of choice. If you or your company are interested in sponsoring the podcast, you can find all the information at realpython.com/advertise. You can find show notes with links to the topics we spoke about inside your podcast player or at realpython.com/podcast. And while you're there, you can leave us a question or a topic idea. I've been your host, Christopher Bailey, and I look forward to talking to you soon.